accessories. In a fine silk shop, I asked a young woman to demonstrate scarf-wrapping techniques. She happily showed off various demure styles. I asked her to demonstrate how to turn one of her scarves into a conservative religious statement. It took some convincing before she obliged. She tied the scarf under her chin and around her face, and then, with an extra fold across the forehead, suddenly she became Orthodox. The power of that last fold gave me goosebumps. She took it off with a shudder. Later that day, a local friend, Melika, took me to Istanbul's Eyüp Sultan Mosque, where all of the women wore their scarves with that forehead fold. Famous in Istanbul as the mosque attracting the most conservative worshippers, even its state-employed female security guards were wearing strict religious headscarves. To Melika, a modern and secular woman, it was striking, even disturbing, that state employees would be seen in this garb. The courtyard outside the mosque was filled with a kind of religious trade fair. Stalls offering free food, literature, and computer programs with a do-it-yourself prayer guide stood side by side. Using incentives to target poor and less educated Turks, it reminded me of the old-school strategy of Christian missionaries. The propaganda seemed mostly directed at women. Melika believes that women, even more than men, are pulling secular Muslim societies like Turkey to the right. Marketers know that women make the purchasing decisions in American families. Considering this, I ponder whether women make the religious decisions in Turkish families and to what degree women really are behind the changes in moderate Muslim societies like Turkey. I told Melika I found it interesting that in both my society and in Muslim societies, women with an agenda can be at odds. She agreed, saying, here in Turkey, while these conservative Muslim women push their agenda in terms of family values, secular women like me push our agenda in terms of women's rights. Many things drive religious people to get political, a desire for economic justice, a moral environment in which to raise their children, equal rights, the sanctity of life, and hopes for salvation. These are powerful forces that can easily be manipulated by clever political marketing. They can drive people to war, and they know no cultural or political boundaries. Observing the enthusiasm of this very religious crowd in the courtyard of the mosque, I could imagine someone who'd never been out of the United States dropping in on this scene and being quite shocked by it all. I asked Melika, should a Christian be threatened by Islam? She said, if you have self-confidence in your system, assuming it deserves to survive, it will. Christendom should be threatened by Islam only if the Christian West seeks empire here. I find an irony in the tensions between America and Islam. I believe we're incurring huge costs, both direct and indirect, tangible and intangible, because our lack of understanding makes us needlessly fearful about Islam. And sadly, I fear that because we're afraid of it, our actions may eventually and, ironically, actually create a situation where we need to be afraid. I wish every American could take a walk through Istanbul with a Muslim friend like Melika. Islam in a pistachio shell. As our generation sorts through the tensions between Islam and Christendom, a rudimentary understanding of the Muslim faith is a good life skill for any engaged non-Muslim. Here's an admittedly basic and simplistic outline designed to help travelers from the Christian West better understand a complex and often misunderstood culture. Muslims, like Christians and Jews, are monotheistic. They call God Allah. The key figure in the Islamic faith is Muhammad, Allah's final and most important prophet. He lived from AD 570 to 632. When Muhammad's name appears in print, it's often followed by the letters PBUH, meaning peace be upon him. Just as Western Christians come in two basic varieties, Protestants and Catholics, Muslims come in two branches. After Muhammad died in 632, his followers argued over who should succeed him in leading his Islamic faith and state, causing Islam to splinter into two rival factions. Today, Shias, also known as Shiites, less than 15% of all Muslims, are concentrated in Iran and Iraq, while the Sunnis dominate the rest of the Islamic world, including Turkey and Morocco. The five pillars of Islam are the same for all Muslims. Followers of Islam should do the following. Pillar number one. Say and believe there is only one God and Muhammad is his prophet. Pillar number two. Pray five times a day facing Mecca, denoted inside a mosque by a niche called a mihrab. Modern Muslims believe that, along with thinking of God, part of the value of this ritual is to help people wash, exercise, and stretch. Pillar number three. Give to the poor 1/40th of your wealth if you're not in debt. And debt includes the responsibility to provide both your parents and your children with a good life. Pillar number four. Fast during daylight hours through the month of Ramadan. Fasting is about self-discipline. It's also a great social equalizer that helps everyone feel the hunger of the poor. And pillar number five, visit Mecca. Muslims who can afford it and who are physically able are expected to go on a pilgrimage or Hajj to the sacred sites in Mecca and Medina, in present-day Saudi Arabia, at least once in their lifetime. This is interpreted by some Muslims as a command to travel. My favorite Muhammad quote is, "Don't tell me how educated you are. Tell me how much you've traveled." Prayer services in a mosque are usually gender segregated. The act of praying for a Muslim is quite physical, repeatedly bending over, and as a matter of practical respect for women and less distraction for both sexes, women generally worship apart from the men. Just as pre-Vatican II Catholicism embraced Latin for tradition, uniformity, and so everybody could relate and worship together anywhere, anytime, Islam embraces Arabic. Turks recently experimented by doing the call to prayer in Turkish, but they switched back to the traditional Arabic. The Quran teaches that Abraham was a good submitter to the will of God. The Arabic word for submitter is Muslim, and that comes from Islam, meaning submit, and mu, one who. So a Muslim is literally one who submits. Wherever I travel, having just a basic grasp of the dominant local religion makes the people and traditions I encounter more meaningful and enjoyable. Exploring Muslim countries leaves me with memories of the charming conviviality of neighborhoods spilling into the streets. Like Christmas is a fun time to enjoy the people energy of a Christian culture, Ramadan is a particularly fun and vibrant time to be among Muslims. My visits to places like Turkey, Morocco, Iran, and Palestine have shown me how travel takes the fear out of foreign ways. The Muslim Call to Prayer. While the call to prayer sounds spooky to many Americans, I find that with some understanding, it becomes beautiful. Traditionally, just before the sun rises, an imam or prayer leader stares at his arm. When he's got enough light to tell a gray hair from a black one, it's time to call his community to prayer. While quality and warble varies, across Islam, the Arabic words of the call to prayer are exactly the same. The first call to prayer of the day starts with an extra line. Praying is better than sleeping. God is great, Allahu Akbar. I witness there is no other God but Allah. I witness Muhammad is Allah's prophet. Come join the prayer. Come to be saved. God is great. God is great. There is no other God but Allah. Big mosques have a trained professional singer. Many tiny mosques can't afford a professional singer, so the imam himself does the call to prayer. The qualitative difference can be obvious. Invariably, my hotel seems to be within earshot of 5 or 6 mosques, which creates quite a cacophony during calls to prayer. My challenge is to hear the Muslim call to prayer as a beautiful form of praise that sweeps across the globe 5 times a day. From Malaysia, across Pakistan, Arabia, and Turkey to Morocco, and then to America. Like a stadium wave, undulating exactly as fast as the earth turns. Morocco, everything but pork. Islam is as culturally varied as Christendom. Turkey is unique among Muslim states because of its European orientation and because of its alliance with the United States, important during the Cold War, Gulf War, and the Iraq War. Morocco, another Muslim country, offers a different insight into Islam. And while many are avoiding travel to Turkey after Erdogan's post-coup crackdown, Morocco remains a welcoming and popular Muslim destination for Western travelers. On my last visit to Morocco, what I found pleased me. A Muslim nation succeeding, stable, and becoming more affluent with no apparent regard, pro or con, for the United States. Artists, writers, and musicians have always loved the coastal Moroccan city of Tangier. Delacroix and Matisse were drawn by its evocative light. The Beat Generation, led by William S. Burroughs and Jack Kerouac, sought the city's multicultural, otherworldly feel. From the 1920s through the 1950s, Tangier was an international zone. That was because it was too strategic to give to any one nation. It was jointly governed by as many as 9 different powers, including France, Spain, Britain, Italy, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Morocco. The city was a tax-free zone since there was no single authority to collect taxes, and that created a booming free-for-all atmosphere, attracting playboy millionaires, bon vivants, globe-trotting scoundrels, con artists, and expat romantics. Tangier enjoyed a cosmopolitan golden age that, in many ways, shaped the city visitors see today. But because of Tangier's international zone status, Morocco's previous king, Hassan II, who ruled from the 1960s through the 1990s, effectively disowned the city. He made a point to divert all national investment away from his country's fourth-largest city, denying it the money it needed for improvements. Over time, Tangier fell into a steep decline. It was a neglected hellhole for a generation. The place depressed me. But the city changed radically in the first decade of the 2000s, and so has my assessment of it. When King Mohammed VI took the throne in 1999, he decided to invest in Tangier and help it to become a great city once again. The difference is breathtaking. While Tangier is still exotic, with its dilapidated French colonial and Art Deco buildings giving it a kind of time-warp charm, it's much more efficient, people-friendly, safe-feeling, and generally likable. Checking into Hotel Continental, I was greeted by flamboyant Jimmy, who runs the shop there. Jimmy knows every telephone area code in the United States. Many years ago, when I told him I was from Seattle, he said, 206. Now I tested him again. He said 206, 360, and 425, new area codes. Hotel Continental has an amazing atmosphere. It had me looking for the English patient. Gramophones gathered dust on dressers under mangy chandeliers. A serene maid painted a sudsy figure eight in the loose tiles with her mop. Day after day, surrounded by dilapidation that never went away. As I updated the information in my guidebook, I found a striking and nonchalant incompetence. My guidebook listed the hotel's phone and email data more accurately than their own printed material did. It's a 70-room hotel with, it seemed, barely a sheet of paper in the office. Roosters and the Muslim culture prayer work together to wake me and the rest of the world early each day. When the morning sun was high enough to send a rainbow plunging into the harbor amid ferries busily coming and going, I stood on my balcony and surveyed Tangier kicking into gear. Women in colorful flowing robes walked to sweatshops adjacent to the port. They were happy to earn $8 a day, a decent wage for an unskilled worker here, sewing for big-name European clothing lines. A reminder that a vast and wealthy continent is just a 2-hour cruise to the north. Cabbies jostled at the pier for a chance to rip off arriving tourists. It's an exciting time in Morocco. Walking the streets, I enjoyed observing a modest new affluence, lots of vision and energy, and at the same time, no compromise with being Arabic and Muslim. The king is modernizing. His queen, a commoner, is the first queen to be seen in public. Moroccans have never seen their king's mother. Imagine such dramatic societal changes in such a short time. Women are making gains throughout Moroccan society. Until recently, a woman here couldn't open a bank account. During my visit, the general director of the stock exchange in Casablanca was a woman. And out of 21 ministers voted into office in the recent election, 7 were female. The Moroccans I encountered didn't emulate or even seem to care about the United States. Al Jazeera blared on tea house TVs with a pointed critique of American culture. But people appeared numb to the propaganda, and the TV seemed to be on that channel for lack of an alternative. I felt no animosity directed toward me as an American. There was no political edge to any graffiti or posters. When I tried to affirm my observations with my guide, Aziz, he explained to me the fundamental difference between Islamic and Islamist. Islamists are expansionist and are threatened by the very existence of Israel. He explained how Al Jazeera appeals to Islamists, but he made it clear that Morocco is Islamic and not Islamist. Wandering in Tangier, especially after dark, is entertaining. It's a rare place where signs are in three languages, Arabic, French, and Spanish, and English doesn't make the cut. Sometimes, when I'm frustrated with the impact of American trade and foreign policy on the developing world, I have this feeling that an impotent America is better for the world than an America whose power isn't always used for good. Seeing those signs reminded me that there's a world that's managing just fine without us. The market scene was a wonderland with everything but pork. Mountains of glistening olives, a full palette of spices, children with butcher knives happy to perform for my camera. Aziz explained that each animal is slaughtered in accordance with Islamic law or halal. I asked him to explain. He took me to a table with a pile of chickens and hollered, "Hey, Mohammed," to catch the attention of a knife-wielding boy. Aziz explained that when he wants someone's attention, he says, "Hey, Mohammed." It's like our "Hey, you," but very respectful. For a woman, you'd holler, "Hey, Fatima." He asked the boy to demonstrate the proper way to slaughter an animal, and I was given a graphic demonstration. In the name of Allah, with a very sharp knife, animal's head pointing to Mecca, body drained of its blood. Before this visit, I had recommended to my guidebook readers that day trippers from Spain just hold their nose and take the organized tour with all the big bus groups from Spain's Costa del Sol. A Tangier guide meets you at the ferry. He takes you on a bus tour of the city, followed by a walk through the old town, where he leads you to a few staged photo ops, the camel ride, snake charmer, Atlas Mountains tribal musicians. After visiting a clichéd restaurant where you eat clichéd food while a belly dancer performs, you visit a carpet shop. Guides and their tour companies must make a healthy commission. Why else would they offer a round-trip ferry ride with the tour for the same price as the round-trip ferry ride without the tour? Being here without a big tour group, I met gracious Moroccans eager to talk and share. About the only time I saw other Westerners was when I crossed paths with one of the many day-tripping groups. As they completed their visit, these tourists walked in a tight, single-file formation, holding their purses and day bags nervously to their bellies like paranoid kangaroos as they bundled past one last spanking line of street merchants and made it safely back to the ferry. I pondered this scene, wondering if these tourists, scared, oblivious, clutching the goodies they traveled so far to pick up on the cheap and then sailing home without learning a thing, were dealing with Morocco this way because it's the same way their home countries deal with the developing world in general. It was poignant for me because, until the lessons I learned from this trip, I was part of the problem, recommending the tour rather than the independent adventure. Some of those needlessly paranoid tourists likely had my guidebook in the bag they were clutching. I wished I could grab their books and update all the information that I now realized was bad advice. While I was comfortable and enjoyed a fascinating Moroccan experience on my own, the frightened tour groups reminded me of some kind of self-imposed hostage crisis. They sailed away still filled with fear, but I was celebrating an Islamic nation that was stable, enjoying a thriving economy, and made me feel perfectly welcome. The tourists were thankful they didn't get ripped off or diarrhea. I had overcome my fear and was thankful Morocco was doing so well. In some cases, visiting a country on a tour ruins any opportunity to really learn about the place. While that may be a lost opportunity and a costly mistake, it can also be a valuable lesson. Any one of those tourists could return and, with a better attitude and better guidebook advice, be welcomed not as a customer, but as a friend. The human, the bear, and the forest. I am a Christian who wants to believe we can live peacefully with Islam. One thing's clear to me. What I learn about Islam from media in the U.S. can fill me with fear and anger. What I learn about Islam by actually traveling in Muslim countries fills me with hope and a desire to better understand each other. Of course, there are real dangers, and rare is the religion with a fundamentalist fringe that wouldn't kill in the name of God. But no society should fear another society simply because their leaders and media say they should. Before anyone hardens their take on Islam, a little travel to a moderate Muslim country can be a good idea. It's a sad irony that terrorism causes many Americans to travel less. If you can't visit in person, travel to Islam vicariously by seeking out connections and friendships at home with people from cultures and religions that are different from your own. The centuries-old tension between Christendom and Islam is like a human sharing a forest with a bear. Both just want to gather berries, do a little fishing, raise their kids, and enjoy the sun. Neither wants to do harm to the other, but because they can't readily communicate, either would likely kill the other if they crossed paths. The world is our forest, and we're sharing it with others. As it gets smaller, more and more cultures will cross paths. Our advantage over the human and the bear, we can communicate. Chapter 7. Europe, not hard on drugs or soft on drugs, but smart on drugs. Because of my travels, I find myself one of the most high-profile people in America advocating for the reform of our nation's marijuana laws. In 2003, I hiked the length of Seattle's sprawling Hempfest, America's largest marijuana rally, for the first time. It became clear to me, these people aren't criminals. Maybe they're doing things some people don't like, but it's not right to make them criminals. Since then, I've joined others in working to legalize marijuana. I'm a board member of NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. And in 2012, I co-sponsored the historic Initiative 502, which legalized adult recreational marijuana use in Washington State. Then, as part of the successful 2014 and 2016 campaigns, I barnstormed Oregon, Massachusetts, and Maine to raise awareness of the wisdom of ending our government's war on marijuana in those states. All of this does not mean that I'm pro-drugs. I simply appreciate how most of Europe treats its drug problem in a pragmatic way, with success measured by harm reduction rather than by incarceration. While in the U.S., year after year, about 700,000 people are arrested with marijuana charges, in much of Europe, discreetly smoking a joint is just another form of relaxation. I speak out on this issue in part because most Americans cannot, out of fear of losing their job or reputation, or both. Of the countless good causes I could get involved in, drug policy reform is a high-risk choice. When I'm interviewed about this on TV or radio, journalists ask me all the predictable, skeptical questions, and then, as soon as the mic is off, they often say, "Thanks for having the courage to speak out." My first thought, that is, if it seems courageous to challenge a law that you believe is wrong, that is, in itself, reason to speak out. Since I own my own business, I can't get fired, and so, when it comes to America's prohibition on marijuana, I can consider lessons learned from my travels and say what I really believe when I'm back home. Today, while the number of states with legal recreational marijuana is approaching double digits, much of our country is still very regressive on drug policy reform. Europe offers a strikingly different approach to drug use and abuse. The U.S. and Europe, two different approaches to drug abuse. There's no doubt that the abuse of drugs, whether soft drugs, such as marijuana, alcohol, and tobacco, or hard drugs, including heroin, cocaine, and methamphetamines, is a serious problem that destroys many lives. Since the 1970s, the U.S. approach has been to declare a war on drugs, with the exception of alcohol and tobacco. In contrast, Europe has attempted a wide range of solutions to the same problem. And while Europe certainly doesn't have all the answers, their results have been compelling and are worth considering. I've traveled with an appetite for learning why Europe has fewer drug-related deaths, less drug-related violence, less drug-related incarceration, and less drug consumption per capita than we do here in America. I must admit, though, that as I reviewed the numbers to back up my claims for this chapter, I discovered one irrefutable fact. Statistics on drug use and abuse are all over the map. While most of the empirical studies reinforce my conclusions, conflicting data always seem to emerge. I assume this is because most sources have an agenda, pro or con, which skews their findings. To be clear, there's no Europe-wide agreement on drug policy. Some countries, including the Netherlands, Spain, Portugal, and Switzerland, categorize marijuana as a soft drug, similar to alcohol and tobacco. Others, including Iceland and Greece, strictly enforce laws against both marijuana and hard drugs. But what most European countries have in common is an emphasis on education and prevention rather than incarceration. They believe that by handling drug abuse more as a public health problem than as a criminal one, they're better able to reduce the harm it causes, both to the individual, health problems and antisocial behavior, and to society in general, healthcare costs, policing costs, and drug-related crime. Generally, Europeans employ a three-pronged strategy for dealing with hard drugs: law enforcement, education, and healthcare. When it comes to law enforcement, police zero in on dealers, not users, to limit the supply of drugs. Users generally get off with a warning and are directed to get treatment. Any legal action respects the principle of proportionality. As far as education is concerned, anti-drug education programs work hard to warn people, particularly teenagers, of the dangers of drugs. And finally, about healthcare, the medical community steps in to battle health problems associated with drug use, especially HIV, AIDS, and hepatitis C, and to help addicts reclaim their lives. When it comes to soft drugs, policies in much of Europe are also more creative and pragmatic than America's. We'll get into an illuminating case study, the Netherlands, later in this chapter. Meanwhile, much of the U.S. seems afraid to grapple with this problem openly and innovatively. Rather than acting as a deterrent, the U.S. criminalization of marijuana drains precious resources, clogs our legal system, and distracts law enforcement attention from more pressing safety concerns. Of the many billions of tax dollars we invest annually to fight our war on drugs, more than half is spent on police, courts, and prisons. On the other hand, European nations, seeking a cure that isn't more costly than the problem itself, spend a much larger proportion of their drug policy funds on nurses, counselors, and clinics. According to the EU website, European policymakers estimate that they save 15 euros in police and healthcare costs for each euro invested in drug education, addiction prevention, and counseling. Learning from Europe, the U.S. should be open to new solutions. It's disappointing for a nation so famous for its ingenuity to simply label the drug problem a war and bring in the artillery. Europeans make a strong case that approaching drug abuse from the perspective of harm reduction can be more effective. And so, to find inspiration, let's take a closer look at how four European countries deal with their drug use. We'll explore the famously tolerant Dutch stance on the soft drug of marijuana, the clever Spanish with their cannabis clubs, the pragmatic Swiss approach to the hard drug of heroin, and, most surprisingly, the Portuguese approach, which has simply legalized the consumption of all drugs, hard and soft alike. The Dutch approach to marijuana. Amsterdam, Europe's counterculture mecca, thinks the concept of a victimless crime is a contradiction in terms. The city, and the Netherlands in general, is well known for its progressive attitude about marijuana. Regardless of your views, it's fascinating to try to understand the Dutch system that, in 1976, decriminalized the personal recreational use of pot. I travel to Amsterdam frequently, and on each visit, as part of my guidebook research chores, I talk to various locals about marijuana. From the guys who run shops that sell marijuana, to pot smokers and non-smokers, and to police officers who deal with the drug problems face-to-face. Here's what I've learned. First off, marijuana is not actually legal in the Netherlands. Dutch law still technically defines marijuana use as a crime. But for nearly 40 years, the nation's prosecutors have made it a policy not to enforce that law under their guiding principle of expediency. It makes no sense to enforce a law that is more trouble than it's worth. The Dutch are justly famous for their practice of hedogen, or toleration. They believe that as soon as you criminalize something, you lose any ability to regulate it. So, just as we tolerate and regulate alcohol and tobacco, they tolerate and regulate recreational pot smoking. But Dutch tolerance has its limits. The moment you hurt or threaten someone else, the crime is no longer victimless and no longer tolerated. That's why Dutch laws against driving under the influence, whether alcohol or marijuana, are extremely tough. The Dutch are well aware of the problems associated with drugs, especially addictive drugs. The Dutch word for addiction, verslaving, means enslavement. Because of the wide-reaching social costs of having citizens enslaved by hard drugs, drugs such as heroin and cocaine are strictly illegal in the Netherlands. And while the police generally ignore marijuana use, they stringently enforce laws prohibiting the sale and use of hard drugs. Throughout the Netherlands, you'll see coffee shops, cafes selling marijuana. The minimum age for purchase is 18, and coffee shops can sell up to 5 grams of marijuana per person per day. As long as you're a paying customer, for instance, you buy a drink, you can pop into any coffee shop and light up, even if you didn't buy your pot there. Because of laws prohibiting the advertisement of marijuana, the customer must take the initiative to get the menu. Locals buy marijuana by asking, "Can I see the cannabis menu?" In some coffee shops, customers actually have to push and hold down a button to see an illuminated menu, the contents of which look like the inventory of a drug bust. The Dutch smoke both hashish, made from the resin of the cannabis plant, and the buds or flower of the plant, which they call marijuana or grass. Pre-rolled joints are sold individually for about $4 to $7, depending on the strain. Joints come in 3 varieties: pure, with a hamburger helper herb mix, or with tobacco. Any place that caters to Americans sells joints without tobacco, but you have to ask specifically for a pure joint. Shops also sell marijuana loose in baggies. They dispense rolling papers like toothpicks, and customers can borrow a bong or a vaporizer. I'm told the better pot, though costlier, is actually a better value, as it takes less to get high, and it's a better high. Because pot is retailed much like beer or cigarettes, varieties evolve with demand. While each shop has different brands, it's all derived from 2 types of marijuana plant: Cannabis indica and cannabis sativa. Indica gets you stoned, a heavy, mellow high. It makes you just sit on the couch. Sativa, on the other hand, is light, fun, uplifting, and more psychedelic. It makes you giggle. Most of the pot sold in Dutch coffee shops is grown locally, as coffee shops find it much safer to deal with Dutch-grown plants rather than to import marijuana. The EU prohibits any international drug trade. Netherlands weed is now refined, like wine. The Dutch are wizards in a greenhouse, and technological advances have made it easier to cultivate exotic strains right at home. You may see joints described as if they'd come from overseas, such as Thai, and indeed the strain may have originated elsewhere. But these days, the marijuana consumed in the Netherlands is generally Dutch-grown. While most American pot smokers like their joints made purely of marijuana, the Dutch, like most Europeans, are accustomed to mixing in tobacco with their marijuana. Back in the 1970s, most locals smoked hash, which needs to be mixed with something else, like tobacco, to actually light up. Pot was expensive, and it was simply wasteful to pass around a joint of pure marijuana. Mixing in tobacco allowed poor hippies to be generous without going broke. And since the Dutch don't cure their marijuana, it's simply hard to smoke marijuana without tobacco. Like the rest of the European Union, the Netherlands enforces an indoor smoking ban designed to protect employees from secondhand smoke. This pertains to tobacco, but not pot. It might seem strange to an American, but these days, if a coffee shop in the Netherlands is busted, it's probably for tobacco. Coffee shops with a few outdoor seats have a huge advantage, as their customers can light up their tobacco and marijuana joints outside. Shops without an outdoor option struggle with an extra challenge, as many local smokers would rather get their weed to go than smoke it without tobacco inside at their neighborhood coffee shop. Coffee shop baristas are generally very patient in explaining the varieties available, and try to warn Americans who aren't used to the strength of the local stuff to try a lighter leaf. Tourists who haven't smoked pot since their college days are notorious for overindulging in Amsterdam. Locals joke that the most dangerous thing about smoking pot is gravity. Baristas nickname tourists about to pass out whitey. That's the color their faces turn just before they hit the floor. To keep this from happening, the key is to eat or drink something sweet. Cola is a good fast fix, and coffee shops keep sugar tablets handy. Legally, while a Dutch coffee shop can sell as much as it likes, it's permitted to keep an inventory of only 500 grams, that's about 1 pound, of marijuana in stock at any one time. A popular shop, whose supply must be replenished 5 or 6 times a day, simply has to put up with the hassle of constantly taking small deliveries. The reason? Authorities want shops to stay small and not become export bases, which would bring more international pressure on the Netherlands to crack down on its coffee shop culture. A few years ago, Amsterdam's mayor, understanding that this regulation just has the city busy with small-time deliveries, proposed doubling the allowable inventory level to a kilo. It's striking to think of a big city mayor grappling with a practical issue like street congestion caused by needlessly small wholesale marijuana deliveries. The wholesale dimension of the marijuana business is the famous gray area in the law. Rather than deal with that complex issue, Dutch lawmakers just left wholesaling out of the equation, taking the don't ask, don't tell route. Most shops get their inventory from the pot equivalent of home brewers or microbrewers. Shops with better boutique suppliers get the reputation for having better quality weed and regularly win the annual Cannabis Cup trophy. Everyone I've talked with in Amsterdam agrees that pot should never be bought on the street. Well-established coffee shops are considered much safer, as their owners have an incentive to keep their trade safe and healthy. The Dutch are not necessarily pro-marijuana. In fact, most have never tried it or even set foot in a coffee shop. They just don't think the state has any business preventing the people who want it from getting it in a sensible way. To appease Dutch people who aren't comfortable with marijuana, an integral component of the coffee shop system is discretion. It's bad form to smoke marijuana openly while on the street. Dutch people who don't like pot don't have to encounter it and rarely even smell it. And towns that don't want coffee shops don't have them. Easygoing as the Dutch may seem about smoking pot, many in the Netherlands want to tighten things up. A few years ago, there was a new movement to recriminalize. Local right-wingers, conservative Christian groups, and the American government have all pressured the Netherlands government to tighten up its marijuana policies. This has pitted federal authorities in the Netherlands against mayors. Generally, mayors who are responsible for crime on their streets advocate for the legal retail sale of marijuana in coffee shops. They know when coffee shops are shut down, there's a spike in the criminal activity that goes along with criminals selling pot in the streets. A 2011 Dutch law sought to close coffee shops near schools, and coffee shop licenses have not been renewed in certain neighborhoods. That says towns and cities want to keep a broad smattering of shops rather than a big concentration in any one area. Consequently, the number of coffee shops in Amsterdam has fallen from a peak of more than 700 back in the mid-1990s to about 200 today. With all this pressure, coffee shop proprietors are scrambling to be good citizens and to nurture good relations with their neighbors. One of the biggest concerns with the coffee shop system is marijuana tourism. It's no coincidence that Amsterdam has become a mecca for harmless but occasionally obnoxious backpackers eager to legally light up. And neighboring countries, France and Germany, complain that it's too easy for their citizens to make drug runs across the border. In response, some Dutch border towns have implemented a weed pass system, allowing pot sales only to registered Dutch citizens. But when that happens, the independent-minded Dutch who don't want to be registered as pot users end up buying it on the street, which rekindles the black market and the problems that causes. Despite detractors, statistics support the belief that the more pragmatic Dutch system removes crime from the equation without unduly increasing consumption. After more than 40 years of handling marijuana this way, Dutch experts in the field of drug abuse prevention agree that while marijuana use has increased slightly, it has not increased more than in other European countries where pot smokers are still being arrested. According to EU statistics, 23% of Dutch people have used pot, compared to more than 30% of Italians, French, and Brits. My Dutch friends also enjoy pointing out that while three recent U.S. presidents, Clinton, Bush, and Obama, admitted or implied that they've smoked marijuana, no Dutch prime minister ever has. Dutch parents generally agree with their country's lenient approach to marijuana. The Dutch have seen no significant change in marijuana consumption among teens, who, according to both U.S. and EU government statistics, smoke pot at half the U.S. rate. Meanwhile, in the United States, in states where pot is still illegal, many teens report that it's easier for them to buy marijuana than tobacco or alcohol, because they don't get carded when buying something illegally. It's interesting to compare European use to the situation back in the USA. According to Pew Research Center statistics, about half of all American adults have used marijuana at some point in their life. Various economists estimate that illegal marijuana is an approximately $100 billion untaxed industry in our country. The FBI reports that almost 50% of the roughly 1.5 million annual drug arrests in the U.S. are for marijuana, and the vast majority, about 84% of those arrests, are for simple possession. That means users, not dealers. Many Dutch people believe that their progressive pot policies have also contributed to the fact that they have fewer hard drug problems than other countries. The thinking goes like this. A certain segment of the population will experiment with drugs regardless. The coffee shop scene allows people to do this safely with soft drugs. Police see the coffee shops as a firewall separating soft drug use from hard drug abuse in their communities. If there's a dangerous chemical being pushed on the streets, for example, the police, with the help of coffee shop proprietors, communicate to the drug-taking part of their society via the coffee shops. When considering the so-called gateway effect of marijuana, the only change the police have seen in local heroin use is that the average age of a Dutch needle addict is getting older. In fact, many people believe marijuana only acts as a gateway drug when it's illegal, because then young people have no option but to buy it from pushers on the street who have an economic incentive to get them hooked on something more expensive and addictive, hard drugs. The hope and hunch is that people go through their drug experimentation phase innocently with pot, and then the vast majority move on in life without getting sucked into harder, more dangerous drugs. Again, the numbers bear this out. Surveys show that more than three times as many Americans report having tried heroin as Dutch people, 1.5% to 0.5%. Studying how the Dutch retail marijuana is interesting. It's also helpful because learning how another society confronts a persistent problem differently than we do can help us envision how we might deal with that same problem more effectively. I agree with my Dutch friends who remind me that a society has to make a choice, tolerate alternative lifestyles, or build more prisons. The Netherlands has made its choice. While America is still building more prisons, the Dutch are closing theirs. My Dutch friends needle me with the fact that the United States has the world's highest incarceration rate, nearly 10 times the Dutch rate, at an annual cost of over $60 billion. I also agree with New York Mayor LaGuardia back in the 1930s when it was becoming clear that America's prohibition on alcohol wasn't working. LaGuardia said that if a society has a law on the books that it doesn't intend to enforce consistently across the board, the very existence of that law erodes respect for law enforcement in general. Spain's cannabis clubs. Marijuana is illegal in Spain. But Spaniards have clever ways of smoking pot without getting arrested. Traditionally, Spaniards call potheads kangaroos. That's because when the police show up, smokers stow their joints not in pockets, which can be legally searched, but under their underpants, where the police can't go without a warrant. This quick stash is done so routinely that Spaniards joke they'll eventually evolve a kangaroo-like pouch just below their bellies. Spain has also innovated its own way to get around its government's insistence on criminalizing the sale of marijuana. they can smoke with their friends and not get arrested by joining social organizations called cannabis clubs. I recently spent a delightful evening at a discreet and tasteful lounge in Barcelona's Gothic Quarter. Any night of the week, its members drop in and enjoy the privileges of being part of their club, to smoke the weed they collectively own without getting arrested. The people I met were happy to explain their system. Cannabis clubs are for members only and not open to the general public. You technically don't buy weed. You co-own its production. Spaniards told me, "We are used to dealing with the old laws that should be changed but aren't. We build little fantasies to dance artfully around them." There's a huge variety of cannabis clubs in Spain, each with its own personality and style. They're funded by annual membership fees. As they can't make any profit, some actually put on impressive and extravagant cultural events just to spend their extra money. Because the big risk is neighbors complaining about the noise or the smell, clubs are often located in edgy neighborhoods and are very careful to keep an extremely low profile. Reputable clubs don't advertise, don't allow minors, keep their clientele quiet, and close at midnight, early by Spanish standards. In Spain, I was told you can smoke with impunity, but if you sell even one joint, you might as well sell a kilo. The police take the sale of any amount very seriously. Generally speaking, Spaniards know there's cheap stuff on the streets, but they prefer to pay more to join a club with predictable quality. Vaporizers may be the rage in the USA and much of Europe, but in Spain, they just don't sell. Whether tobacco or marijuana, Spaniards simply love the ritual of actually smoking. While the Dutch, and to a lesser degree the Spanish, are lenient in their marijuana laws, many other European countries are also progressive on this issue. I've chatted with people passing a joint as they played backgammon in the shadow of the cathedral in Bern. They told me that marijuana enforcement is stricter in Switzerland each spring at the start of the travel season so the country doesn't become a magnet for marijuana tourism. And I've talked with 20-somethings in Copenhagen rolling a joint on the steps of their city hall. They explained that because of an international trade agreement the United States wrote and pushed through the United Nations, they have to be careful, because the Danish government is required to arrest a couple of pot smokers each year in order to maintain favored trade status with the United States of America. The Swiss approach to hard drugs. Marijuana is one thing, but hard drugs, such as heroin, are another. And even as some European countries are liberalizing their approach to pot, they draw a clear distinction between soft and hard drugs. Hard drug abuse is a concern in Europe with an estimated 2 million problem users, just as it is in the United States. There is no easy solution, but the pragmatic European approach based on harm reduction rather than punishment for an immoral act appears to have had some success. Switzerland has been at the forefront of these efforts. The last time I was in Switzerland, I dropped into a cafe in downtown Zurich, went into the bathroom, and it was all blue. I had stumbled into another example of creative European drug policy. The Swiss, who don't want their junkies shooting up in public bathrooms, install blue lights. If you can't see your veins, you can't shoot up. Of course, this minor frustration wouldn't stop junkies from finding a fix. Across the street is a machine that once sold cigarettes. Now, it sells hygienic, government-subsidized syringes, 2 for a franc, less than a buck apiece. The Swiss recognize that heroin doesn't spread HIV or other deadly diseases. Dirty needles do. Then, when the addict needs to shoot up, he or she knows that they can go down the street to a heroin maintenance clinic and get the services of a nurse and a counselor. Swiss society sees addicts as people who are sick rather than criminal. And programs like this help addicts stay alive, get off welfare, and rejoin the workforce. Clinic workers told me that in Switzerland, crime and AIDS cases related to heroin have decreased, while recovery and employment rates among their clients have increased. When addicts aren't nervous about where they'll get their next fix, consumption goes down, and so do overdoses. When demand on the street goes down, so does the price. This brings down street violence and is bad news for a pusher's bottom line. With clean needles and a service helping assure reliable purity, potency, and quantity, maintaining the addiction becomes less dangerous. With these provisions, you still have an addict, but you remove crime, violence, money, and disease from the equation so you can treat it for what it is, a health problem for people who are screwing up their lives and need help. As Swiss addicts are safely dosed to maintenance levels, they begin to reclaim their lives, get jobs, pay taxes, and in many cases, kick their habit altogether. Switzerland's heroin maintenance centers, now also in other countries like Germany and the Netherlands, succeed in reducing the harm caused by drug abuse. While heroin maintenance programs have been relatively successful, Europeans have tried and failed with other programs. For instance, experimental needle parks, places where the hard drug-taking community could gather, ended up attracting junkies and creating a public nuisance. These were abandoned for the more low-key maintenance centers. But at least Europeans are dealing with the challenge openly, innovatively, and compassionately. In contrast, some observers suggest that the United States' more punitive policies toward addicts cause junkification. They marginalize addicts and drive them to dangerous, predatory behaviors, from simple stealing to mugging, prostitution, to selling drugs to others. In other words, if you treat heroin addicts like they're dangerous junkies, that's exactly what they'll become. The casual American observer who sees more junkies on the streets of Europe than in the United States may conclude they have a bigger drug problem because of their more lenient drug policies. In fact, according to the 2016 United Nations World Drug Report, the percentage of Western Europeans who use illicit drugs is about half that of Americans. The difference is that theirs are out and about while working with these centers and trying to get their lives back on track. Ours are more often either dead or in jail. Through its busy maintenance centers, Switzerland has overseen literally millions of heroin fixes, and they've not had a single overdose death. The United States is suffering a tragic opioid crisis, with well over 50,000 deaths in 2017 caused by overdoses. Meanwhile, Europe in general, with a larger population and roughly the same number of hard drug addicts, loses only around 10,000. Sadly, recent White House policies are throwbacks that will make things worse, not better. Like my European friends, I believe we can adopt a pragmatic policy toward both marijuana and hard drugs, with a focus on harm reduction and public health, rather than tough-talking but counterproductive criminalization. Rather than moralizing and locking people up, it's time to have an honest discussion about our drug laws and their effectiveness. I've learned from my travels that when it comes to drug policy, you can be soft, you can be hard, or you can be smart. The Portuguese approach to all drugs. Imagine if all drugs were legal. One European country has attempted that, with results that may surprise you. Portugal lived under a repressive right-wing dictator, Antonio Salazar, for a generation. Typical of repressed societies celebrating an end to tyranny, when the Portuguese rid themselves of their dictator in 1974, many went overboard on their newfound freedoms. One consequence, a spike in people addicted to hard drugs. In the 1980s and 1990s, little Portugal had about 100,000 hard drug addicts. A group of experts came together to find a solution to this problem. With the goal of establishing a legal framework for harm reduction, they enacted Law 30, which effectively decriminalized the consumption of all drugs, soft and hard. As of 2001, severe criminal penalties for possessing small amounts of any drug were replaced with slap-on-the-wrist punishments. After a decade, the new conservative government, which had by then replaced the more progressive government that established Law 30, assessed the law they once opposed. They deemed it to be smart and effective. The number of people who reported that they had tried various drugs increased a little bit, possibly because it's more comfortable to admit drug use when it's legal, but there was no significant change in routine use rates from the time when drugs were illegal. While use rates increased shortly after the new law went into effect, they dropped back down a few years later. Similar use increases in Italy and Spain during this same time period suggest that the brief spike was unrelated to the new law. And drug use among adolescents actually declined with the implementation of Law 30. Portugal now has half as many addicts, fewer people with HIV, and more people in treatment. The police, now freed up to focus on violent crime, appreciate the measure. The burden on Portugal's prisons and criminal system has lessened, and the relationship between the Portuguese government and its drug-using population went from adversarial to advocate. Even former opponents of the law have agreed that its benefits far outweigh its harms. Decriminalized drugs, both hard and soft, will continue to be Portuguese law of the land. Every society needs to find its own solutions, and not every solution is a good fit for every society. But it is good to learn from other societies who are thinking out of the box to deal with problems that also plague our society. And Portugal's Law 30 certainly has drug policy experts paying attention. Paths and barriers to legalization. With the thought-provoking success stories in the Netherlands, Spain, Switzerland, and Portugal, why don't more countries take a chance on experimenting with their drug laws? Simply put, they're afraid of the United States and retribution. The United States, by way of the United Nations, has rigged the system to prevent change. If a country legalizes, it risks being decertified by the United Nations. This means it's disqualified from receiving foreign aid, and the United States Congress is required to vote against them in trade policies, effectively sparking an expensive trade war. Even the United States' own drug czar is required by our government to vote to keep drugs illegal. Europe has come up with clever ways around this. That's why you hear the word decriminalization rather than legalization. It's all about exploiting loopholes. Many European countries have anti-marijuana laws on the books, but choose not to enforce them. Even in the Netherlands, marijuana is still technically illegal. They've just legislated themselves around those laws. Europe wants science over ideology. Wealthy countries who want to legalize can tinker around this way because if they go too far, they can absorb the potential cost of a trade war with the USA. But poor countries, scraping to get by, simply can't afford the risk of trade sanctions and must carefully toe the line. In 2012, several Latin American countries, including Mexico, Costa Rica, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Colombia, began talking about the wisdom of taking the crime out of the drug equation to help alleviate some of the violence racking their societies. The White House sent emissaries with a strong message to cool it, and Latin America's found themselves between a rock and a hard place when trying to take the violence and the money out of their local drug wars. Perhaps this might change if some bold American states took the initiative to legalize marijuana and test the system. Oh, wait, that already happened. The Prohibition of Our Age. Travel teaches us a respect for history, and when it comes to drug policy, I hope we can learn from our own prohibitionist past. Back in the 1920s, America's biggest drug problem was alcohol. To combat it, we made booze illegal and instituted prohibition. By any sober assessment, all that prohibition produced was grief. By criminalizing a soft drug that people refused to stop enjoying, alcohol, prohibition created the mob, Al Capone and Company, filled our prisons, and cost our society a lot of money. It was big government at its worst. Finally, courageous citizens stood up and said the laws against alcohol were causing more problems than the alcohol itself. When prohibition was repealed in 1933, nobody was saying booze is good for you. Society just realized that the laws were counterproductive and impossible to enforce. In our own age, many lawyers, police officers, judges, and other concerned citizens are coming to the same conclusion about the current U.S. government-sponsored prohibition against marijuana. Legal pot in the United States of America. While decriminalization efforts in various European countries have tested the waters, legalization on U.S. soil would be a game-changer worldwide. Like our international neighbors, American drug policy reformers have used loopholes to fight the federal war on pot. More than half the states have legalized the use of medical marijuana. In 2003, my hometown of Seattle voted to make the enforcement of laws against recreational pot smoking the lowest priority for its police force. Tired of running down innocuous pot smokers,